1 Timothy chapter 3. Here is a trustworthy saying. If anyone sets his heart on being an overseer, he desires a noble task. Now the overseer must be above reproach, the husband of but one wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not given to much wine, not violent, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. He must manage his own family well and see that his children obey him with proper respect. If anyone does not know how to manage his own family, how can he take care of God's church? He must not be a recent convert, or he may become conceited and fall under the same judgment as the devil. He must also have a good reputation with outsiders, so that he will not fall into disgrace and into the devil's trap. Deacons, likewise, are to be men worthy of respect, sincere, not indulging in much wine, and not pursuing dishonest gain. They must keep hold of the deep truths of the faith with a clear conscience. They must first be tested, and then if there's nothing against them, let them serve as deacons. In the same way, their wives are to be women worthy of respect, not malicious talkers, but temperate and trustworthy in everything. A deacon must be the husband of but one wife and must manage his children and his household well. Those who have served well gain an excellent standing and great assurance in their faith in Christ Jesus. For some of us who have been members of Eden for a long while, I suspect that this routine, you could almost say, of studying this passage or one very similar to it before a church election might sometimes be just a little bit tedious, and we might just be tempted to groan inwardly that here it comes again, the Constitution decrees that we must listen to it all yet once more. Well, I can sympathise with that. I feel the same I've done this talk now I don't know how many times in the last 11 years, and I feel that same feeling a little bit myself. Nevertheless, there is great wisdom in the fathers of our church who laid down this rule for us, because we are a very rapidly changing church. There are always new members coming in as old members leave us. And it's important that we keep united around the scripture in this matter of church elections, because there's probably no single issue which is more potentially injurious to a Christian fellowship or hazardous for a church's future than the election of its officers. Countless examples could be quoted of churches that have been brought to a state of schism or decline or even apostasy as a result of bad choices in the matter of leadership. So it is wise, even if some of us have heard it before, to remind ourselves of it, or for some of us maybe to learn it for the first time, as we give ourselves to a careful study of what the Bible has to say on this matter. There are, in fact, two key passages regarding qualifications for church office. One is the one we've just read in 1 Timothy 3. The other is in Titus chapter 1. And there's quite a lot of common material to the pair. There are a number of things one can say very quickly that arise out of those two passages, and particularly out of this one, which perhaps are worth noting, though it'll be familiar to many of us. One very obvious thing is that the apostle seems to assume that there will be a plurality of leadership in the church. He talks about elders and deacons, or overseers and deacons. An overseer, or as it's sometimes translated, a bishop, was the same office as the elder in the early church. That can be shown, I think, quite conclusively, because the two terms are used interchangeably in a number of references. And they seem to have been responsible for the spiritual leadership of the congregation. Deacons, another plural group, seem to have had responsibility for material welfare in the congregation. And that's the way, certainly, that our church structure here at Eden is divided between two groups, two teams of leaders, elders and deacons responsible for those two areas. And I think, though it wouldn't be true to say that the Bible lays down a rule on the matter, that we are at least following the model of 1 Timothy 3 in organising ourselves in that way. Plural leadership with a division of labour, then, between elders and deacons. That's one very obvious conclusion one can draw from the general expectation, the general teaching of 1 Timothy 3. Another thing I think that's very easily observed, which is worth noting, is that Paul seems to assume that people who serve in this category will be volunteers. If anyone sets his heart on being an overseer or an elder, he desires a noble task. He doesn't seem to anticipate that he'll have to get the whip out, or that people will have to be dragooned into this service. He seems to assume that there will be people in the church who will aspire to leadership. I think that is worth noticing, because it is possible to err on the other side. A number of the prophets in the Old Testament were very reluctant to assume the job that God gave them. And some of us in entering the ministry, perhaps, as pastor teachers, have felt that similar reluctance. But that needs to be balanced by what Paul says here in that opening verse of 1 Timothy 3, that there is nothing wrong with a person aspiring to leadership. He's desiring something which is a very noble, a very demanding task. But if he sets his heart on it, Paul seems to feel that there's nothing wrong in that. Certainly we require that elders and deacons who are appointed in this church shall be willing to serve. Peter himself says that officers in the church must be willing, not forced into the job. So plural leadership, volunteers, these things come out very simply from the passage. And some of the qualifications for such leaders are also very obvious and what you might expect. For instance, Paul says quite a lot about doctrinal orthodoxy and commitment on the part of the church's leaders. He says in verse 9, for instance, of deacons, they must keep hold of the deep truths of the faith with a clear conscience. So deacons must have a personal grasp of sound doctrine, and they must hold to it honestly. It mustn't just be a kind of fiction that they a tick that they apply to in a sort of formal way to the church's statement of faith in order to be accepted as officers. They have to genuinely, from the heart, sincerely hold to these deep truths of the faith. Of elders, in Titus 1, verse 9, we read that they must not just hold firmly to the faith, they must also be able to encourage others in the doctrine of the church. And he says, to refute those who oppose it. And that perhaps is a clue to the difference between the office of teacher and of elder and deacon. Deacons have to be men who are doctrinally orthodox, but they don't have a teaching function in the church. They don't have a spiritual authority in the church in the same way that the elders do on doctrinal matters. It's the elders' task to defend the faith and see to it that the church holds the line on Christian truth. This, of course, is increasingly important the more young a congregation, the more new converts there are in a congregation. In a sense, the more successful a church is evangelistically, the more vital is that it pays attention to that particular qualification in its leadership. Another thing which both the passages in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 emphasize in regard to leaders is that their family life should be examined. Are told, for instance, in 1 Timothy 3, that the leader must be the husband of but one wife. That reminding us that, of course, in the early church, polygamy was something which was known. And although a man, it seems, was not required to abandon all wives but one in order to become a member of the church, which would have been a disastrous thing socially if you think about it, nevertheless, a leader of the church must be a husband of one wife. He was not to be a polygamist. That seems to be the implication of that verse. Similarly, requirements laid down regarding the children of leaders. They must obey the father with proper respect. They must not be open to the charge of being wild and disobedient, says Paul in Titus 1. In both these cases, the requirement regarding a single wife and the requirement of children being respectful and obedient, the key to understanding why those things are laid down probably lies in two things. First, the issue of leadership irreproachability. An overseer must be above reproach, says Paul in verse 2 of our passage, the husband of but one wife. That seems to be the leading idea then, that there must be nothing in this man's domestic life, in his marital life, which could be a possible source of scandal and embarrassment for the church. He must be above reproach. Similarly, his children must not be a source of embarrassment to the church. In the ancient world, in certain circles at any rate, the behaviour of children reflected very heavily on the ability of the parents to govern their own home. And disobedient children were regarded as a stigma on the family. So similarly, the leading idea probably in regard to the rule about children may well have something to do with irreproachability, that the leader must be somebody that the world respects for his family life. The other idea that's probably related to this whole question of examining the man's domestic life concerns his ability to manage, to lead, his competence, to direct a group of people. If he can't manage his own family, says Paul in verse 5, how can he take care of God's church? Paul, if you like, sees the elder as having a paternalistic, fatherly role within the congregation. If he can't be a good father in his own biological family, how can he possibly be a good father of the church, the spiritual family? So the irreproachability of leaders in their domestic affairs and their competence as leaders being tested and proven by their conduct of their family life, that seems to be an important consideration. But interestingly, the major emphasis in 1 Timothy 3 and in Titus 1 doesn't fall on theological erudition or even on managerial gifts and skills and so on. What I want you to notice tonight is that the chief concern the apostle has in laying down qualifications for leaders here relates to character. It's not a matter of theological degrees or pastoral gifts or anything of that sort. It's godliness. Holiness. Now that's a very important observation. We live in a pragmatic age. The emphasis in the world is usually these days on what a man can do, what he knows, rather than what he is in himself. The qualifications we look for are A-levels or skills, things to prove that he's a motor mechanic or a builder or something. Very rarely do we ask for character references, or even if they are asked for, very rarely does anyone take any notice of them. I usually get asked for character references, but it's quite clear it's a matter of form these days, because in 9 cases out of 10, the person's already been given the job before I even get the letter asking for the reference. Even in jobs where character is enormously important, for instance, in the professions like medicine and law, increasingly the issue is, will he make money for the firm, rather than will he be a credit to the firm? And I'm afraid the same attitude really clogs our mind often when we consider leadership in the church. We're more concerned to know if the man is good at this or that than to know if he is simply good. Now, Paul's advice contrasts markedly with that. He is concerned that leaders should be gifted, of course. He talks about elders being able to teach, for instance, that deacons should know how to manage their own families so they can manage the affairs of the church and so on. But his chief emphasis is not on personal qualifications of that sort, but on personal quality. The sort of man, the sort of person we're talking about. In fact, perhaps the most remarkable thing about 1 Timothy 3 is that though the elder or bishop and deacon seem to have been responsible for different areas of the church's life, nevertheless, the qualifications for these two offices are practically identical. It's very little to distinguish them. It's as if the precise function a man exercised in the church was of far less importance in Paul's mind than the spiritual worthiness to be a leader in the first place. Let's look then at some of these character traits which Paul says we should look for in people we're going to appoint as leaders. We can group them, I think, under two or three headings. The first heading that might be useful to us is self-discipline. There are several words that relate to this. 1 Timothy 3 verse 2, he talks about an overseer being self-controlled and temperate. Titus 1 verse 8 uses the additional word disciplined. All these words have the same basic thought to them, that a leader must be a person who keeps a firm watch on their own behaviour, who doesn't need to be told what to do, but has a kind of internal monitor that controls their behaviour in a godly way. The word self-control, for instance, literally means having a sound mind, and it describes a person whose judgment is never swayed by passion or whim. It describes a person whose sense of responsibility and discretion can always be relied upon. The word disciplined, on the other hand, which Titus uses, usually relates to the physical rather than the mental realm. It's often used of an athlete in training, but in this context it probably doesn't mean that a leader has to have a build of a he-man or something like that. It's probably being used in the more narrow sense of sexual chastity. For the word was often used in that way too, to describe a person who had his body under tight moral control. And the word temperate that we find there in verse 2, in some ways a bridge between these other two words, because it's often employed as the opposite of drunken. And it implies both the sobriety of mind and moderation of the appetites. And that particular aspect of self-control, of course, is one which Paul specifically repeats. He must not be given to much wine, he says, both of elders and deacons. And in Titus we're told the same. So self-control embraces a lot of what Paul is saying we should look for when we're looking for leaders. People who demonstrate this catalogue of temperate, self-controlled, responsible behaviour. Another aspect of self-control relates to the temper. Paul says a leader mustn't be violent or quarrelsome. And again, Titus adds the phrases, he mustn't be quick-tempered or overbearing. There are, of course, those who may be very high-principled and theologically informed, but who are victim to a certain belligerence of temperament that renders them very dangerous in church leadership. Maybe you've met people like that. Leadership in the New Testament church maybe is always plural for that reason, that we want to have a team spirit. The man who leads has got to be somebody who's not so egotistical that he wants to just lead the thing on his own in a kind of arrogant way, sitting on some kind of infallible throne. The New Testament doesn't have much time for monarchical pastors standing 6 foot above contradiction in infallible pulpits. Church ministry is always team ministry, and so a person who can't work in a team just isn't suited to the task. So maybe it's wise to ask questions like, can he be criticized without flying off the handle? Is he argumentative? Is he always having a row with somebody? Does he tend to get on his high horse over minor issues and make a big fuss? Does he tend to push his point of view so forcibly nobody else dares to contradict him? To use a positive word that Paul selects in 1 Timothy 3, is he gentle? Do you see that in verse 3? Not given to much wine, not violent, but gentle. That's a very beautiful word. It's a word which is almost untranslatable in English, but it means really being willing to meet the other person halfway. It means graciousness, cordiality, a kind of easygoing, you would say, temperament. Somebody who's not going to fly off the handle and get angry and self-opinionated about things. Temper, then. Paul's advice is absolutely vital here, surely. If you want harmonious leadership in the church, we have to choose people who can keep their cool. People who are flexible enough, charitable enough, to shake the hand of somebody who disagrees with them rather than black their eye. Self-control in mind, in body, in appetite, and in temper. Yes, and there's one more thing that Paul mentions that a person should be self-controlled about if they're going to be a leader, and that's the use of their tongue. Two things, he says, are involved here. One is truthfulness, in verse 8. Deacons are to be men worthy of respect, sincere. That's the word he uses. Literally, not double-tongued, not given to double speech. A leader, he's saying, must be a person who always speaks with integrity, who doesn't adjust his words to suit his hearer. He must have the moral courage to tell the truth. Very important for a leader. But equally, Paul balances that in verse 11 with the word kindness. Not malicious talkers, he says. Literally, not devils. That's the Greek word there for malicious talkers. For the devil, of course, is a slanderer. That's what the word means. That's what he does. He's constantly trying to expose the moral weakness of Christians by slandering them. He's the self-appointed prosecuting counsel of heaven.
It's his business to accuse us before God's justice, and he's never more delighted than when he wins a case. And there are people who share his taste for scandal and defamation of character. Paul actually, if you read carefully, identifies a chief culprit in this matter too in verse 11, doesn't he? In the same way, their wives are to be women worthy of respect, not malicious talkers. I don't know whether the ladies want to accuse Paul of being a chauvinist here in directing that particular word specifically at them. But it could be said that if there are characteristics, sexual characteristics and leading faults, malicious talk is something that you sometimes find, perhaps a little more often, on the tongues of the ladies and the gentlemen, though not that much often, I wouldn't like to say. But there is an ambiguity here, and it might be worth just noting it. Some commentators take this verse to mean the wives of the deacons, and that's how NIV translates it. But you could equally well, seeing as there's no possessive pronoun here, interpret this to mean office-bearing women in the church, deaconesses, as we might call them. The women who lead the work of the church in respect to women in the fellowship. So not the wives of deacons necessarily, but women who belong to the orbit of deaconal service. It's a matter of some controversy, as you will be aware at the moment, exactly which interpretation you place on that verse, and I'm certainly not going to get involved in it now. Whichever way it is, there's no question that women, whether they be the wives of leaders or have some leadership office themselves in the church, women are required by Paul to watch carefully their tongues, as indeed men are also. Self-control is a primary leading qualification for any kind of leadership office in the church. Another area of character, which we can group a number of things together under, in this list, is the whole attitude to possessions and money. Notice several times this is mentioned with various connotations. For instance, both in Titus and Timothy we find the word hospitable. A leader is to be a generous-hearted person, a person who loves the stranger. That's what the word literally means. The sort of person who doesn't have a kind of clique of his own family and friends that monopolizes attention, but has an open heart and a generous heart to everybody. Generosity. And showing that in material things. That, of course, is of special relevance here in Cambridge, where there are so many people from all over the world. It's a word we need to take on board very, very strongly. Generosity of spirit, then, that ought to characterize leaders. And scrupulous honesty in regard to financial matters too. In verse 8 we read, not pursuing dishonest gain. And we read something similar in verse 7 of Titus 1. The reason for this, of course, is that elders and deacons are in a position of trust in the church. Often they will have access to church funds and church property. Often it will be the deacons who sign the checks, for instance. And it only takes one incident of petty theft to destroy the credibility of the church leadership in the eyes of the church members, and in the eyes of the general public, and to bring a great deal of trouble upon a congregation. So a leader's honesty must be absolutely impeccable if he's to hold office. And the way to assess this, says Paul, is maybe to examine his business life. Is he a person who goes in for shady deals and sharp practice? As he puts it here, pursuing dishonest gain. Is he the sort of person who's always discovering mysterious boxes that have mysteriously fallen off lorries? If so, he's unlikely to be able to command the necessary trust within the church. And another thing which Paul says, which relates to this general area of money and property, is contentment. Notice in verse 3, he says, not a lover of money. Not a lover of money. Not just honest, then. Not just generous. But having an attitude towards material things which isn't obsessive. There are two mistakes, of course, it's possible to fall into with regard to material affluence. We've talked about them on a number of occasions. Those of you who were here back in June will remember we looked at some verses in 1 Timothy 4 where Paul urges that we don't give way to asceticism and treat God's creation, material things, as if they were valueless. That's one mistake you can make. You can make a virtue of poverty, as if it was somehow superior to have no car, no television, no washing machine, no carpets, etc., etc. The other mistake, of course, that you can make is to surrender to materialism, to center your whole life around the pursuit of status symbols and luxury goods, to measure success in terms of the size of the house, the quality of the car, the fashionability of the clothes, and so on and so on. And both of those extremes are wrong. Well, first, because it denies that material things are God's creation, and therefore good. But the second, because it idolizes God's creation, turns it into a false god. Paul sets an important balance when he says we're not to be lovers of money. Money is something we have to know how to handle. But we're to be contented people. The Christian virtue is to be content with what we have. Neither to admire money nor to despise it, but to be content with what we have. And that's really what Paul is describing here when he says an elder mustn't be a lover of money. It doesn't mean that an elder must live in the cheapest possible accommodation and eat the cheapest possible food and wear the cheapest possible clothes and so on. That would be to insist that an elder should be a monk. Some religions may admire such mortification, but Christianity isn't one of them. No, as far as money goes, Christian character demands three things: generosity, honesty, and contentment. And there's one third category that we perhaps can link one or two things together under to complete the picture that Paul gives us here of the qualifications for church office. We've looked at self-control and all the things that relate to that. We've looked at money and material things and what relates to that. The third category I'd call spiritual maturity. For you'll notice that in 1 Timothy 3 verse 6, Paul says, he mustn't be a new convert. Now, it's instructive why Paul says maturity is important. It's not important, as you might expect, because of the man's lack of experience or lack of biblical knowledge. You might expect that that would be the thought in Paul's mind. It's not even the question of him being too young. Paul's main concern in saying that he mustn't be a recent convert is the spiritual danger into which election to office can easily lead an immature Christian. For he says in verse 6, he mustn't be a recent convert, or he may become conceited and fall under the same judgment as the devil. That either means that just as the devil fell through pride and self-assertion, so an elder in the church might find the office goes to his head, and so his service would be ruined. Or it's just possible, Paul may be thinking rather, that this conceit in the man will be a grounds for some of that slander. They're not thinking of the devil with a capital D, but slanderers and gossips, people who enjoy picking holes in church leaders, will find some grounds for criticism if the man is lifted up with pride. But whatever the precise sense is, the main lesson is clear. The first response anybody feels when they're told that they've been nominated for office in the church is to feel flattered. Flattered that they've been asked. It wouldn't be human if we didn't feel that. But we don't dare to let that inclination to vanity take root too deep in our hearts, because Paul says it could jeopardize our whole service. The character requirement that Jesus requires of any leader, in addition to self-control and self-denial, is self-effacement. Humility, we would say. The rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, not so among you. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. That was Jesus' rule. Whoever wants to be first among you must be slave of all, even as the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Humility isn't easy. It's not something you learn quickly. Like love, the other leading virtue of the Christian life, it's the fruit of a renewed personality. True love and true humility are more than anything else qualities which show the Holy Spirit has been at work in someone's life and moulding them into the likeness of Christ. It doesn't come quickly. And new converts are not infrequently very lacking in it. We've all met the new convert who's very bumptious and self-confident, haven't we? Don't we all cringe, perhaps, to remember some of the things we said and did as very young Christians? I certainly do. We knew all the answers. We didn't need to be told. We could see all the mistakes the church was making very clearly. Boy, oh boy, what a revolution we were going to have when we got into power. It took time, not a few humiliations perhaps, before the Lord purged that haughtiness out of our manner, and even longer before he purged it out of our hearts, and some of us perhaps are still battling with it. Well, let's be quite clear then. Paul is not saying that it's wrong to appoint a young person to office always, when he says he mustn't be a recent convert. In that sense, the word elder may mislead us, because although it does imply seniority, it doesn't necessarily have reference to age. Timothy, to whom this letter is written, was a young man by Middle Eastern standards. Paul tells us that explicitly, and he says no one was to despise him because he was young. So Paul is not saying a church officer must be a geriatric, but he is saying that he must be spiritually mature. The young convert is unsuitable, not because he's young, but because Christian character isn't produced overnight. And Christian character is what somebody must have if they're going to be a leader in the Church of Jesus Christ. Let's spend just a few moments in quietness as we let those thoughts and that teaching seep into our minds. Those of us who are church members need to take it on board as we think about those men who are standing for office at the end of the month. And perhaps we need to commit to some of the things we've learned to memory too, the passages that are relevant, if we need to look them up again. So let's just take a brief time of quietness to get some of this inside our minds and inside our hearts.